From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today on the show, the former mayor of Oklahoma City explains how the future of mid-sized city depends on millennials.
They're looking for a better quality of life, a more urban environment, less auto-centric lifestyle. And that's where opportunities like Milwaukee and Oklahoma City have opportunities to kind of continue to plan purposely about what type of cities we want to have.
Then the stars of the Milwaukee Reps play guards at the Taj say their roles are more than just another acting gig.
The play is so poetic. There's so much you can take with you. I mean, I still find moments while doing the play, make discoveries about humanity, about myself, about what beauty means to me, what does order mean to me.
Plus, we'll have the latest installments of Radio Chipstone and our storytelling series, Ex Fabula.
Lake Effect Weekend is next. News is first. Good afternoon. This is Lake Effect Weekend on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. The history of almost every American city features a series of boom and bust cycles. Milwaukee in the 1950s was a bustling manufacturing metropolis. But the city's fortunes fell in subsequent decades, and while the downtown has made a recovery, other aspects of the city are still a work in progress.
It's a story Mick Cornett recognizes. Cornett served four terms as mayor of Oklahoma City from 2004 to 2018. That city was virtually on life support in the 1990s, but is a completely different place as a result of several key policy decisions and some specialized taxes voters approved. Cornett believes it's a recipe other mid-sized metropolitan areas could follow as well. His new book is called The Next American City, and Mick Cornett joins us on the line. Welcome to Lake Effect.
Great to be on with you.
So I actually want to start this interview by asking you about the end of your book. How do you see the story of mid-sized metros, and Oklahoma City in particular, paralleling your own story? I mean, this is about reinvention, isn't it?
Well, it is. I went through a period of my life. I thought I had the greatest job in the world. It's what I always wanted to do growing up, and that was be a television sportscaster. And I was living the dream. And at some point, especially after the bombing that took place in Oklahoma City, and I just realized I wanted to do something different with the second half of my professional life. I was assigned to go cover City Hall. Kind of fell in love with local government. Felt like that's where a person could make a difference. And I left television, started my own business, ran for city council, and then ultimately served as four terms as the mayor. So, yeah, it's kind of been a reinvention. And I now that I'm not the mayor, I've got this book out, but I'm looking at, what adventure do I have left in me?
Well, and so when we look at cities like Oklahoma City and other cities its size, the Milwaukees of the world, but also the Buffaloes and other places, what you're really writing about is their ability to reinvent themselves.
Well, that's right. Everybody loves the rags-to-riches story, and almost every city out there is always evolving. You're either going one direction or the other. Oklahoma City's probably come as far as fast as any city in the country, but that's because it had a long way to go. I mean, you go back to 1990, and Oklahoma City probably had the worst economy in the country. And things are different now. And I watched some of my predecessors work, learned from them along the way, and then tried to stand on their shoulders and move the city forward. But cities can't ever, think that they've solved an issue because, tomorrow there'll be new issues to solve and you got to keep moving. It's one of the frustrations of creating a city and a better city is that you never reach your destination. You've got to always keep planning and always keep inventing. And here's what's interesting to me, Mitch, going forward, is that over the next couple of decades, you're going to see these mid-sized cities like Oklahoma City and Milwaukee have great opportunities to attract the millennial generation and the generation coming in just behind it. And what it appears is that they are more attracted to cities that size than the big cities, New York, Los Angeles, and San Francisco. They want to be able to afford a house. They don't want to spend their hours in traffic congestion. They're looking for a better quality of life, a more urban environment, less auto-centric lifestyle. And that's where opportunities like Milwaukee and Oklahoma City have opportunities to kind of continue to plan purposely about what type of cities we want to have.
Right. You were talking about where Oklahoma City was, say, 25 or 30 years ago. For folks who haven't been there, can you kind of contrast what it looked like in 1990 or 95 with what it looks like today?
Yeah, it was desolate. I mean, the downtown core was just emptied out. I mean, there were some tall buildings, people worked there, but at 5 o'clock when people went home, there was no nightlife. There was one hotel in downtown Oklahoma City, and it was struggling. Very few people lived downtown. There were no restaurants, no retail, and all of the life of the city was out of the suburbs. And we became a suburb of nothing, and the core was dying or was dead. And we had a business-minded mayor who realized we had to invest in ourselves. And so he passed an initiative that kind of started reinventing from a capital perspective in the inner city, amenities to bring people downtown. And it was a game-changing event. And ultimately, I think even though, you know, even today, most people, you know, don't live downtown. A lot of people do, but most people don't. People generally care about their neighborhood and they care about their downtown. There's an emotional attachment to the core of the city, and that's very important to get people to buy into some of the changes that are necessary. Because, you know, this highly educated 20-somethings, the group of people that I think all mid-sized cities are hoping to attract, they're highly selective. They're looking for a vibrant urban core. They want a walkable downtown and walkable entertainment districts and things to do. They want to be culturally relevant. And, you know, Milwaukee and a handful of other cities are set up to succeed if we do it right.
Right. So, I want to ask you about taxes, because I know you describe yourself as a small government conservative, and that seems pretty par for the course for Oklahoma. And yet it sounds like many of the successes Oklahoma City has claimed in the past couple of decades have come as a result of local government and sometimes business leaders being able to go to voters and making the case for raising money to do things. So, you know, what's the secret sauce? What's the argument that really resonates with people that makes them want to invest?
Well, I believe in efficient government and doing what you say you're going to do. And I think one of the success stories in Oklahoma City is that local government has developed a certain level of trust with the citizens. And we've largely used this taxation principle for capital structures. And people in Oklahoma City seem to have differentiated between the type of taxes they're willing to consider and the type they don't like. They like these capital programs where the taxation is for a certain number of years and then the tax will go away. We don't use debt in that type of funding formula. In other words, we collect the sales tax and then start the process of building these amenities. And so, you know, debt doesn't accumulate. And in a very conservative political environment, people in Oklahoma appreciate that aspect. But people just want, you know, they want their money's worth, and they want elected leaders who do what they say they're going to do. I mean, it's not complicated, but it's not universal. And I think that's one of the reasons that Oklahoma City has been so successful with its initiatives.
How important do you think it is for a mid-sized metro to have what basically amounts to a brand for itself, you know, to be known nationally or internationally for something or in some way?
Well, it's critical. And, you know, unfortunately, cities don't really control their brand or are not in complete control of their brand. You know, we had been branded by tragedy. When I was elected mayor in 2004, I used to travel and talk about Oklahoma City, and I could see on people's faces, the moment I said Oklahoma City, they had that image of the bombing from 1995. Then a tornado went through the edge of our city in 1999, and it was called the Oklahoma City Tornado. And so you have these horrific events that put a negative image on our brand. And so that's when I started going to the NBA and NHL offices in New York and starting talking to them about trying to get a major league city in Oklahoma City so that we could a major league team in Oklahoma City so we could start to work on our brand and get us associated with something positive. I mean, Milwaukee is well branded. I mean, through the decades, it's very strong in pop culture and people know it for different reasons. And that awareness is something that Milwaukee can build on and continues to.
Do you think our cities our size, Milwaukee's and Oklahoma City's and others, are they more susceptible to these boom and bust cycles that have happened over the years than New York or Los Angeles?
Well, probably, because maybe the economies are probably a little more similar. You know, you've you need to have a diversified economy to the extent you can. And in Oklahoma City, we spent 25 years trying to diversify, and it feels like we've finally done that. We had been such an oil and gas community for decades, and now we've invested in aviation and biomedical and tourism and things like that. So having a diversified economy is critical to avoiding the bust. You're always going to have the national economy being somewhat cyclical, too. So you don't need a local economy that's overly cyclical as well. I think that's critical, because if you go into any city and you look at the architecture and you look at the most important aspects of the built environment, generally they're built in the good times. And you can kind of look at architecture in a big city and kind of determine when they had their good times and when they didn't.
I'm curious whether this phenomenon exists in Oklahoma as well, and you'd be in a good position to kind of understand it. Is there a rural-urban divide that exists? I guess the question I have is whether, you need to bring the rest of the state in on ensuring the success or the success of its major metropolitan areas, and how you convince, rural Oklahoma that what's good for Oklahoma City is good for them, or in a place like Milwaukee, Milwaukee and rural Wisconsin.
Yeah, I think there's a rural-urban divide in almost every state in the country, and we've seen that in Oklahoma as well. There is a role that the big cities play, and there is a role for smaller and rural communities to play. And what we need, I think, at least part of the answer, and I'm not saying this is something that's easy to solve, but what we need is elected officials who are trying to bring people together. I think it's important that, we don't continue to divide up at every opportunity. We have so much partisan politics and so much divisiveness at the national level. At some point, we've got to come together, and hopefully that can be at the local level. And so people, regardless of whether they're urban or rural or whether they're Republicans or Democrats, can realize that our community, our state, is not going to go forward unless we get more people pulling on the same rope. But the funding at the state capitol, I know, is critical. And, on an annual basis, it seems like there's rural legislators and urban legislators who are fighting needlessly and not in the best interest of the state as a whole.
All right. So I am curious where you see the story of Oklahoma City's civic weight loss effort fitting in this bigger picture.
Well, that was an awareness campaign that I launched 10 years ago when we were showing up on the list of the most obese cities in the country. And I think as an awareness campaign, it's done a tremendous work. And now, here 10 years ago, we're seeing our health statistics in the city improve. So, that's been a journey that I learned a lot along the way and wrote about in the book. I think it's an example of how you can take something that's a negative statistic or a negative image or something that's tough to overcome, make it positive and try to make it in a whimsical way, something that people can rally around. I believe positive energy is important if you're going to institute change. And when you're talking about obesity, it's hard to find positive energy, and we were able to do that.
There's something in the idea of leading by example as well.
Well, yes, I suppose so. And I've had people say that my own weight loss journey was a critical part of that story. And I suppose that's true. But, I think some things, require a conversation and some things we don't want to talk about. And I think obesity is one of those issues we're not comfortable talking about normally. And what I did was I went to the zoo and I stood in front of the elephants and I told the entire city I was putting them on a diet. And we were going to lose 1 million pounds. And sort of the whimsical nature of that, I think, put a positive spin on a very difficult issue. But it created a conversation. Suddenly you had a community that was talking about a very tough issue. And talking about it, obviously, is the first step in addressing it.
Mick Cornett is the former mayor of Oklahoma City. He fell short in his bid for governor this year. He's also author of the new book, The Next American City, The Big Promise of Our Midsize Metros. And we should note that despite a lifetime of living in Oklahoma, he is a lifelong Green Bay Packers fan.
A short break now, and then we'll speak with two stars of a bloody good show at the Milwaukee Rep, a preview of Guards at the Taj, when Lake Effect Weekend continues on Milwaukee's NPR. Thank you. More of Lake Effect Weekend now on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. The new production at the Milwaukee Rep, Guards at the Taj, is less than 90 minutes long, but that's plenty of time for the two-person show to cover plenty of ground. The play, which features two men standing guard before the Taj Mahal is revealed to the public, is at turns funny, biting, thought-provoking, and a little, sometimes a lot, bloody.
The play was written by award-winning playwright Rajiv Joseph and considers what happens when ordinary people are caught up in difficult circumstances with difficult demands of them. The Rep production stars Awais Ehemmet and Yusuf Sultani, who both joined us in the studio recently and talked about the nature of mixing humor with uncomfortable situations.
I think it's the point. The thing is like, dark comedies appeal to me so much because they're a mirror of actual life. Your actual life, in one day, you can go through an emotional roller coaster of things that happen to you. You know, you're going to be laughing one second and during your day, and then you hear some tragic news about something that happens on TV, and then, you know, you're grief-stricken. And this play is very much like that in the sense that you'll be laughing completely and hysterically, and then the next moment, it's like someone punched you in the gut, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Is there a challenge as an actor to doing that in a way that, I don't know, do you want to feel manipulative or not? If that's a fair question to ask.
Well, you know, our jobs as actors can sometimes be really difficult because you have to be really present. And in order to serve the text really well with its full intentions, even we have to be really present to the moment that's coming up and not think about it. So it comes as a surprise to us because the audience, I feel, is another character itself. So they are another character in the play that's listening and interacting with us. And they're going on this journey with us. And as we're making discoveries, they're making discoveries. And that part's where Yosef is talking about, where we get punched in the gut, that happens to us. And the visceral reaction, hopefully, will transcend to the audience as well.
Well, I always wonder about this when you have actors and they're doing a play that is funny and you're doing it night in, night out over the course of the run of the show. It really you really have to be in a position where it still feels as natural to mm-hmm. you the 15th time you've done it as it did the first and the second.
Oh, yeah. During rehearsals, we play with it consistently. We'll have to stop because we make each other laugh in the middle yeah. of the scene. So during a performance run, I think you continue to find new things after each performance. You'll surprise yourself, as you should. You know, the journey doesn't end until the curtain closes on the final night. And I really believe that it starts from the first day of rehearsal to the final day. So you'll never have you'll have a finished product, but at the same time, that product is always evolving. So things that are funny one night might land for the audience, and we find it funny, but it might not, and that's okay. The moments change, and the dynamic shifts between scenes consistently. You're never going to have the same show, and that's the great part about live theater.
Does your timing change based on the reaction of the audience?
I believe so. Yes,
it's going to. If somebody laughs in the audience, and you have to pause for that, then you know you have to pause for laughter.
And if there's a matinee crowd that's very enthusiastic compared to the night crowd, we'll have to play with them. But
Are matinee crowds more enthusiastic?
No, that was me being a little sarcastic.
Oh, okay. You didn't pick up on that? Yeah, we'll have to. He's a good actor, I promise you.
This is true.
Well, no, you're such a good actor that I believed you.
Thank you, Mitch. Thank you. Just wait till you see me doing the play. Yep.
this sounds like as good a time as any to actually hear you do a quick scene from the play.
Absolutely.
Great. Okay, so just briefly, in this one scene, it's a great contrast of what's actually happening because we're in the act of cleaning up all of the blood, and it's this really tragic, depressing scene to watch. But then the content of our actual conversation is hilarious, so it's a nice juxtaposition of what's happening on stage. And in this moment right now, they're talking about inventions. Your flying invention with the seatbelt? That was a good idea. I, too, have an invention. I have an invention, too. A transportable hole. It's literally a hole you can take anywhere with you. And anything you attached it to would suddenly have a hole in it. Say you wanted to go through a wall? You could. Or say you're trapped in a dungeon. Or you're in the desert and it's so hot. Hole in the ground? Now you can sleep in some shade. Also, there would be things to eat inside the hole.
What would there be to eat?
I don't know. Beef curry? Paratas?
It wouldn't fall out?
What?
Food wouldn't fall out of the hole?
No, it would be in the hole.
But the hole's a hole.
A transportable hole.
How do you carry it?
Carry what?
The transportable hole.
It would have a sack.
A sack?
Inside the sack, transportable hole.
What if I were in the sack?
Why would you be in the sack?
For example, if I was?
It's not a very big sack. You wouldn't fit.
It's a small sack.
Big enough only for the transportable hole.
It's a small hole?
Small enough to fit in the sack, but then, as holes are, it could grow and shrink in size.
But what if I were in the sack?
You wouldn't be in this. As I've said, it's a small sack.
Say I was very small.
Suddenly, you are very small.
Yes.
Small enough to fit inside the sack.
Yes, I'm trapped, see? Inside the sack.
How did you shrink?
There was a potion from some witch.
Okay.
So now I'm very small, and someone has gone and put me inside the sack.
With the transportable hole.
No, the transportable hole isn't there yet. It's out of the sack.
You took it out of the sack?
I didn't take it out. It was already out when I was captured and put in the sack.
Who took it out?
The boss man who owns it?
Maybe the emperor.
You would think the emperor.
Seeing as the transportable hole is probably a very rare and expensive thing.
That's what I was thinking. Not everyone gets a transportable hole. Too many transportable holes would be a bad idea, as they might take up everything. The whole world. And then what? What if everything was a hole? I have another invention, too, which is for something you put inside the clouds.
Wait, go back to when you're inside the sack.
Oh, yes, because I've shrunken to a very small size.
How small? Like a child?
No, like a doll a child plays with.
That's very small. And you're in the sack.
Trapped inside because the boss man, probably the emperor, captured me and put me in there.
Punished for being too small.
But because the sack I'm in is also the sack to transport the transportable hole is now put in the sack with me. Now, I'm in a sack that has a hole in it. So, can I escape?
Well, you could just go right through the hole.
Exactly.
That's what the hole is for.
But could the transportable hole, wouldn't it also fall through its own hole?
Could the hole fall through itself?
It's a good question.
Sure, it could.
Well, if it could, then the sack isn't a very good sack with which to carry it.
That is true.
Nothing could carry it.
Nothing could ever carry it.
And then how do you take the hole places?
You couldn't. Nobody could. It's a useless invention.
Unless you had two sacks, and the hole simply led to the other sack. So even if the hole did fall through itself, it would end up in the other sack, and then back again in the corresponding sack, like an hourglass. Yeah.
This is like Abbott and Costello clean up blood in front of the Taj Mahal.
Totally.
Basically.
We should talk a little bit about the play itself. I mean, the two of you are playing Imperial Guards. They're posted in front of the just about to open Taj Mahal. And at the heart of the play is this long-standing story about the people who built the Taj.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
In that, in so much as the emperor who ordered the Taj made decided or decreed that nothing would ever be as beautiful as the Taj, and thus, I'll let you fill in the story from there.
Well, it's a legend. It's a myth, and the story's been passed down for generations. And the amazing playwright Rajiv Joseph went to the Taj, and he'd heard these things, and I saw this interview where he'd written this amazing play with lots of different characters, and it was a fully completed, realized play. And then they were staging it, he was workshopping it, and then he was, while watching it, fixated on these two guards in the corner who were actually having a conversation during rehearsal. And he was like, "That whatever's happening right there is so much more interesting than what's happening on stage right now. I'm going to scrap this whole thing and write a play about these two guys and then base it around this myth, this legend of how Emperor Shah Jahan decreed that nothing so beautiful as Taj Mahal shall ever be built again." And in this myth,
yes, he ordered the 20,000 workers to never build anything as beautiful again. And according to myth, that people say that he ordered the hands to be cut off. Now, I was just at the Taj in India, actually, and my tour guide was telling me the story, and I was like, yeah, I know. And he's like, but do you know the same root word for taking hands is also writing? And I was like, oh. So he was like, yes, actually, what happened was they made people sign contracts that they will never work again and never build something as beautiful as the Taj Mahal. So from that transpired this
cutting off
this
hands,
this myth of like that again. He ordered the hands to be cut off. which I think is a fun myth because my grandma and my mom used to tell me that. And they'd be like, at the end, actually, it didn't really happen. I was like, why are you scaring us?
Princess Bride.
but like with many myths, there is this grain of truth, or it became a myth because there was something at its heart that actually did happen.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah.
What do you think people are going to be asking themselves as they walk out of this play?
Well, hopefully they leave with a sense of, basically the play itself is the relationship of these two guys. It's friendship. But ultimately in current world, our zeitgeist right now, I think it deals a lot with the relationships between ordinary people and authority. And that's a big struggle in this play. And that's the difference between these two characters. One of them very much wants to be within this box and these rules and follow the rules and pleasing authority. And the other one's more, into inventions and the outward view of things of the world and its correlation with him as a being. It's things that have a little bit more weight to it, in my opinion.
These guys could be concentration camp guards. They could be foot soldiers in Rwanda. Or they could be
two regular guys. Yeah. Yes. I think that's the best part about this play is that anybody who comes to see this show can really relate to these characters. They're incredibly emphatic and sympathetic.
The play is so poetic. There's so much you can take with you. I mean, I still find moments while doing the play, make discoveries about humanity, about myself, about what beauty means to me, what does order mean to me. And the play also deals a lot with masculinity. What does it mean to be a man? What does it mean to be in touch with your emotions? How much of that are you told to shove out in the rug? And where do these ideas come from? So yeah, it's a really poignant play. And I'm excited to share this play and this work with the Milwaukee audiences.
Had you already gotten this role when you visited the Taj?
Yes. Yes, I found out I was doing the role, and I wanted to see the Taj Mahal before I started it. So I impulsively, which costs a lot of money,
This is like not like an impulse buy at 7-Eleven.
No. I wish it cost as much, but I didn't. But it was beautiful there. It was totally worth it.
And have you been?
I have not, no. We talked about going together and, I was still in the process. It was only a 2-week span, so the fact that he made that happen, I'm pretty impressed and admiring of the fact that he was out there. We FaceTimed while he was there.
Yes.
And the morning he woke up at 7 o'clock in the morning, and it was, I guess it was about like 10 o'clock at night.
I woke up at 5, actually, to get there.
It was beautiful.
To see it at dawn.
Yeah.
Ugh. It's gorgeous.
I mean, and I just saw it off an iPhone. It was in the background, and I saw his beautiful face, and it was joyous. I could see the elation on his face, and I felt the passion that he felt seeing it through him, and it was a beautiful thing that he was able to FaceTime me. But yeah, that experience, the fact that he came with that kind of experience already under his belt is pretty amazing.
Hey, when we do the show on Broadway, we'll have to go before we do that show.
Yeah, maybe the theater will pay for it.
Yeah. It's going to be Broadway. Of course they're going to pay for it.
A 2-week span, the jet lag alone makes that a staggering achievement.
You have no idea. Oh my gosh, jet lag's real. I haven't gone overseas in 15 years, and jet lag kicked my butt.
He got back Sunday, and then we started rehearsals Tuesday. So he was right, like, he's fresh off of the plane, having just seen Taj Mahal.
I looked like a mess. People were like, no, you look fine. And I was like, no, this is one of those moments where I actually look like a mess.
Who told you you look fine?
People said it very politely. Hey, I see what you did there.
Well, listen, it is a terrific play, and the two of you are wonderful representatives of it sitting here in the studio with
me.
I am honored to have you both here, and thanks so much.
Thanks, Mitch.
Oweys Ahmet and Yusuf Sultani star as Babun and Humayun in Rajiv Joseph's Guards at the Taj, which runs through November 4th at the Milwaukee Rep. You'll find more information at WUWM.com. We would be remiss if we didn't point out that playwright Rajiv Joseph's other works include a play called The Lake Effect.
We will take another break now and then return with the latest installment of Radio Chipstone. Lake Effect Weekend returns right after this on WUWM.
Lake Effect Weekend continues on 89.7 Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Are you one of those old school museum attendees whose head whips around to investigate even the whispers of a conversation? If you are, you are in good company because our material culture contributor, Jennifer Fields, is also one of those people. even though she says she's working on it.
During a weekly visit to the Chazen Museum of Art in Madison, Fields heard the sound of what turned out to be a group of art history students. These students were part of a race and representation in American art class led by teaching assistant Mark Summers, a PhD candidate in the art history department.
In this edition of Radio Chipstone, Summers was gracious to entertain questions from Jennifer, who noticed a lack of diversity in the students present in the museum. He starts by explaining how that shapes class discussions.
There are people of color in some of the classrooms, some of the small group sections, and even if we don't have those people of color, we can still talk about how white people have represented whiteness and other races in American art since the foundation of the country.
When the students aren't represented in each of the small groups, are you getting the full story? Because you're still looking at it from your own particular bias. They're still looking at it from their own particular bias. And not bias in the sense of racism, I'm not talking about that, but through their own particular lens. Do you have opportunities to have group discussions with everyone so that you can hear all sides of it? And what are those discussions like when you're able to have them in the room? Do you feel like they're frank? Do you feel like you can get down to it?
It's hard to have a discussion with 256 students in a classroom, but I mean, we do the best that we can. I think it's still an important conversation that we need to be having.
Do you think that's part of it? Do you think that part of what the issue is having the time? Because you're a teaching assistant, so you've got a PhD candidate. You have all kinds of things that you're doing also, Mark. Is that part of the issue, though, with finding the time to have those discussions in smaller groups that are meaningful?
I think it's important to do the best that you can. I mean, we don't choose who enrolls in our classes here, so.
How do we get a wide range of people interested in, how do we get them in museums? How do we get them to see art history as a viable area of study?
Great question. I think that we can do it by trying to have courses that are topical and that are tackling tough issues that are present in today's society that young people and I think older people too want to have this conversation. Oftentimes in these classes, we have students who are going to the museum for the first time. There are students in my class today who have never been to a museum before, but I think that that's something that should be addressed earlier if you can. But you're also working with access to museums. There's not a museum in every town.
Material culture contributor Jennifer Fields curates the Radio Chipstone series. The project is funded by the Chipstone Foundation, a decorative arts foundation whose mission is preserving and interpreting their collection as well as stimulating research and education in the decorative arts.
This week, Jennifer spoke with Mark Summers, a teaching assistant for race and representation in American art in the UW-Madison Art History Department.
We have time to feature a song here on Lake Effect Weekend by Welsh singer-songwriter Martin Joseph. Joseph has a new album, his 20th since 1982, called Here Come the Young. Here's the title track recorded in the Lake Effect Performance Studio while he was in Milwaukee recently.
Here come the young, with open minds and hearts, inclusive from the start. Here come the young, here come the young. Might just see the day, you best get out the way. Here come the young, they're tired of all your fighting, and they're tired of all these years, tired of blazing crosses, and they're tired of narrow fear, and they're tired of smelling hunger, and they're tired of hearing lies, they're tired of the big divide, and these tired girls and boys. Here come the young, with open minds and hearts, inclusive from the start. Here come the young, here come the young. They might just see the day, you best get out the way. Here come the young, they're tired of assassination, and they're tired of military threat, they're tired of the talk of the trickle down, and they're tired of crippling debt, and they're tired of corporations, and they're tired of broken trust, and they're tired of being slaughtered, and their dreams that turn to rust. Here come the young, with open minds and hearts, inclusive from the start. Here come the young, here come the young. Well, they might just see the day, so you best get out the way. Here come the young. Thank you. Well, they're tired of rising oceans, and they're tired of bigotry, tired of racist leaders eroding their liberty, and they're tired of a lack of shame, and they're tired of failed accord of colluders in a private game, and they're tired of law ignored, and they're tired of their future being taken from them now. So you better watch your back, sir, 'cause they're coming for you now. Here come the young, with open minds and hearts, inclusive from the start. Here come the young, here come the young. Well, they might just save the day, and you best get out the way. Here come the young, here come the young. With open minds and hearts, inclusive from the start. Here come the young, here come the young. It might just save the day, you best get out the way. Here come the young.
That was Welsh singer-songwriter Martin Joseph performing Here Come the Young, the title track from his latest album, ahead of a Saturday performance in Madison. The recording was engineered by Jason Reavy, and you can hear the full story behind the song at WUWM.com.
We'll take one last break, and then we'll have our storytelling series, X-Fabula. Like Effect Weekend returns right after this on Milwaukee's NPR.
Three, two, one.
Welcome to X-Fabula!
True personal story.
X-Fabula!
X-Fabula is a Milwaukee nonprofit committed to strengthening community bonds through the art of storytelling.
And it is X-Fabula Radio Time once again, part of Lake Effect Weekend on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bruce Winter. Co-founder of Milwaukee's X-Fabula, Leah Delaney, also comes in every week bringing us stories from Story Slam's past based on a theme and usually pointing forward to something that's coming up. And
yes,
you did it again.
We did it again. We have our first non-competitive storytelling event, which is going to come up on October 9th. It's going to be held at Sugar Maple. Mm-hmm. And the theme of that night is misunderstood. So this is the first non-competitive event, and it's for those who feel more comfortable in a non-competitive event where you can just come and share.
I like that idea. I really do, because I feel there's more openness and willing to share if you're not feeling like you have to, you know, be the best or compete somehow.
Win, win, win. Right. Yeah. And we feel that a lot of Milwaukee, due to the surveys that we sent out, feels the same way.
You listen. So
we listen. Yes. We cater. We make it happen. We have a couple more events coming up soon, and which we'll talk about in a couple minutes, but let's just jump right into our stories.
Sounds good.
Great. So our first misunderstood story is from one of our X-Fabula fellows, and this was told at our event, Talking to Your Kids About Race, which happened in April of 2018. So let's listen to Monica Bonilla.
I was a typical 13-year-old student at Morris Middle School, which is on about 70th and Lisbon. You know, I started my day out in history class with Mr. Allen. He was black, and he was like the best teacher ever. So I loved going to his class. And on this particular day, he started talking to us about how to protect ourselves in case we were ever victims of assault. And I'm sitting there thinking, why would my teacher be talking to us about like how to protect ourselves? I feel safe in my neighborhood. So he started out by saying, if you ever feel or someone attacks you, the first thing you do is if you have a jacket on or a hoodie, put that hoodie up. And if they're gonna throw you to the floor or before they throw you down, you know, try to put that hoodie up and get on the floor right away and get into a fetal position. And no matter what you do, do not take your arms away from your face. So I was like, whatever, you know, we're teenagers. I'm like, it didn't seem important at the moment, but little did I know that that was gonna help me that day. The day went by, I got on my school bus and got to my house. I got off at my bus stop with a girl that I still remember until today. Her name was Gloria. and she was carrying her little violin. And we just had to walk 2 blocks to get to the house, just 2 blocks. So I'm like, you know. So as I was walking down the street, a group of teenagers or high school teenagers always called me names, but I was taught just ignore and keep walking. Don't listen to them, you know? So I did the same thing that day, and I was carrying this tri board and my US history book on top of the tri board in my backpack. And as I'm walking down the street and I get to the corner, ready to cross to get on my block, someone grabs me from behind my neck, and I just go back and I fall to the ground. And it was right there where Mr. Adams' words came to my mind, and I put up my hoodie and I got into that fetal position and I protected my face. And I was scared. I don't know, to me it felt like a million people kicking me. They were kicking my legs, my back, my head. And all I could do was yell for help, and I called Gloria for help. I told her, Gloria, help me, you know? And I was panicking. I thought, what if they stab me? What if they kill me? Like, I didn't know what was gonna happen. So I wanted to make sure Gloria was there with me, so I opened my arms, and surely they started kicking me in my face as well. So, but Gloria was still there, so that made me feel better. And out of nowhere, a car miraculously came and started beeping, and that made the 3 teenage girls that were Hispanic walk away. And I remember getting up from the floor and turning around and yelling at them, why did you do this to me? What have I ever done to you? I don't know you. But I realized at the moment that it didn't matter, because they really didn't care. So I walked to my house and I knocked on my door as usual, and my brother opened the curtain, my older brother, and then he closed it right away playing around. But this time that he saw me, he opened the door and he said, what happened? And I'm like, well, you know the high school kids that always bother me? Well, this time they beat me up. And he grabbed, his first instinct was to run inside, grab a bat, and run out there. And I could imagine why. My face was starting to get swollen. I was bleeding. And my dad saw me, and he saw my brother run out, and he's like, wait, what are you doing? He's like, no, we're calling the cops. You know, I don't want you to get in any problems. I can't defend you, and it's not worth it. We're gonna call the cops. So there he goes. He calls the cops. The cops get there, and my parents aren't fluent in English, so I told them the story, told them what happened. And after that, their response was, well, you know what? There's not that much we can do. Most likely, your daughter's part of a gang. And you know, there's nothing we could do. And my dad was offended. He kicked them out of the house, and he said, get out of my house. And that's how it ended. It's just, it made me feel, I saw right away the injustice that happened, and it made me think, had we lived in Brookfield, Wauwatosa, Whitefish Bay, would the police response have been the same? Would my teacher, my history teacher, be talking to me about how to protect myself in my neighborhood? And I guess I hope that one day my daughter doesn't have to put her hoodie up to protect herself.
And that was Monica Bonilla's story about being misunderstood. Happens way too much within
indeed.
The communities.
Yes, indeed.
So we will have another story in a couple moments, but I do want to talk about an event we're having prior to our non-competitive storytelling event on October 9th at Sugar Maple. It's sort of like a pre-event. It's a special event where XFabula is going to join Greater Milwaukee Foundation with an on-the-table discussion, Your Voice Matters, Community Conversation Initiative. So if anybody would like to pre-register for that event that happens right before the non-competitive slam, please go to xfabula.org for that. That's going to be a really important conversation that we all can have together in a safe environment. Mm-hmm. So again, you can get your information on that at xfabula.org for the On the Table, Your Voice Matters Community Conversation Initiative.
You guys are doing some good stuff. I like this.
We're trying. We're really trying. And for those who are still thirsty for the crown, we've got a second XFabula Story Slam. This one is competitive for the XFabula All-Stars title. And that's going to happen on October 25th. And the theme of that night is Crush.
Okay. Crush?
Yeah.
Oh.
It's going to be super fun.
Oh. I want to be there. I want to be there.
Okay, good. All right. Well, let's get back to the final story from our theme of the day, which is misunderstood. This one is from Sean Mitchell, who is another Exfabula fellow. And the story was told at our Embracing Cultural Diversity. Here's Sean Mitchell.
So TCP / IP stands for Transmission Control Protocol / Internet Protocol. It's basically the communication model for all networks around the world, including the internet. All right, now it's complicated, but you wouldn't know that. You're not a computer networking professional. But if you were in 2001, you'd have been making about $150,000 to $200,000 a year, and you'd have all the work you could ask for, right? Now, this is before the iPhone, it's before Android, you know, even before those Motorola Razr phones, right? So, January of 2001, there was a snowstorm, a little bit after my 31st birthday. Big snowstorm, slush, just like the one we just had. There I was, on my back, in the middle of General Mitchell Airfield, changing a drive shaft. Freezing slush, right? I'm hating every moment of it. And all I can think of is my friends in Jacksonville, Florida. And not because of the weather, but because all of them had gone to ITT Technical Institute. And they were all now working for Cisco and Microsoft and companies like that, and definitely not changing drive shafts. I had done this work 12 years in the Navy prior, and when I got out, I went to Midwest Express, and it paid well, and I had a family to feed, and the job was familiar, so I continued to do it, even though I absolutely hated it. Drive shafts aside, the rest of the stuff, the oil, the rags, I wanted to do something different. All right, they say be careful what you wish for, but it really should be prepared what you wish for, because when you know it, summer 2001, Midwest Express starts its slow decline towards failure. I'm laid off in around the first wave of 200 people. There I was, faced with a decision, all right, what I was gonna do. I still got the same 6 kids, still got the wife, everything else. And I dropped out of high school to join the Navy at 17. I left unexpectedly at 29 with little more than a GED. So I knew the first thing I needed to do was upgrade my education. So where did I go? I took my GI Bill and I went to ITT Technical Institute. All right? I was gonna become a computer networking professional. Now, this was one of the harder fields at ITT. It's a 4-year degree, it's not very easy, and they tell you from the beginning, you really need to start paying attention to the first classes, particularly one called Networking Essentials. It sets you up for the rest of the degree field. And they found that most people who failed the degree field failed this class first or didn't pay attention very well in this class. So they had assured us that the instructor we were gonna have is a guy who had been in the industry for over 10 years, right? He was gonna show us everything we needed to have. I was confident I was gonna get it. The classes were on Saturdays and they're from like 8 a.m. to like 1 p.m. and it's hot and we're waiting for the instructor, we're all fanning ourselves, and in walks a middle-aged man, small stature, and as he begins to speak, we all lose confidence. ITT had built its success on diversity. It got instructors from all over the globe. For some of these instructors, English was a third or fourth language. Now imagine trying to learn TCP/IP. Already a complicated subject from someone you can't understand. That first class was murder. Hands up everywhere because no one could understand what he was saying. And this didn't end by the end of the class. This went on for Saturday after Saturday. Till finally, I went to the administration and asked the administration to do something. The administration, as they should have, they stood behind the instructor. And they told me I needed to work it out. So one Saturday morning, I went in early, I sat down with the instructor, and as I began to speak to him, I noticed that the slower he spoke, the better I understood. One student after the other came into the classroom, and we all began to develop this language where we could speak to one another. I finished the class with a B+. Everybody in the class passed. What I learned is that diversity is not just about putting people together, different skin tones. It's about diverse communities. It's about, you know, diverse cultures and backgrounds being mixed together to come up with a better outcome. Right? If we can all work together and use our best, we can achieve everybody's common goal and your individual dreams. Thank you.
And that was Sean Mitchell's story that he told at our Embracing Cultural Diversity. You know, it's such a interesting point of fact. You could be sitting inches away from somebody or miles away from somebody across the world, and you don't know exactly what their culture is mm-hmm. until you start listening and getting to know somebody. So it's just fascinating moments.
Nothing replaces that kind of communication.
Mm-hmm,
so,
mm-hmm.
One thing that stuck out to me too is maybe as a sidebar to his story is how technical learning in just 10 years' time has changed so much. And the school he went to, I don't think exists anymore. I'm not sure, but I'm sure what he learned a decade ago doesn't apply all that much anymore. Things change so fast. So.
Oh, definitely. What do we do without email? I have no idea what I was doing.
Well, let's review these upcoming events because you have three good ones here.
Yeah. Okay, so on Tuesday, October 9th at Bayview's Sugar Maple, we are going to have our first non-competitive story slam where the theme is misunderstood. Please note that we do have a partnership with Greater Milwaukee Foundation right before that event. And that is going to be an on-the-table discussion, community conversation happening. So registration is free. You just need to pre-register for that event. And get your tickets for the Story Slam, by the way, well on xfabula.org. And then on top of it all in October, we have our October Competitive Story Slam, which is going to be on October 25th, and the theme is Crush. Mm. So bring your crush stories, Milwaukee. Bring your misunderstood stories next week. It's just going to be a heck of a month, and we hope to see you there.
Now, we don't expect you to remember everything she just said, so it's all available at xfabula.org. And to share today's stories again or listen to them again, it's at wuwm.com. We thank you for listening. We thank Leah for bringing the stories in, and we'll see you next week.
Sounds good.
XFabula is a regular feature here on Lake Effect Weekend, and it wraps up another edition of the show. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you for making us a part of your afternoon. Lake Effect Weekend airs every Saturday and Sunday from 3 to 4 on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Stay tuned now for All Things Considered coming up next. It's 4 o'clock.